Thank you. Okay, last week, what we noted about history is that it's God's plans as they pass through time and space and through the agency of man. We said that the residue of that is what we call history. And so this morning, what we're going to do, we're going to start beginning to examine that residue, and we're going to look for the fingerprints of God as He is molding and shaping that history. Now, you might notice that much of what we'll discuss in the next few weeks is what we might call secular in nature. That is, we're going to be looking at the history of empires and conquerors that shaped the ancient world, but who aren't usually associated with the history of the church. And that's intentional. It's designed to be something of an object lesson. The lesson is this, that while the attention of history has been on these great figures and these rise and the fall of these empires, the truly significant events went almost unnoticed as they led up to the coming of Messiah. Now, the title of our lesson is The Crucible of the Captivity. And a crucible, of course, is a vessel in which metals are heated until they are molten. That allows them to be purified because the impurities, the dross, rises to the top where it can be removed. And that imagery is going to apply to this lesson today. Nobody can apply heat and pressure to a people like God, and nobody can purify human hearts but God. And that's exactly what's going to happen in this lesson. Because God is going to bring the nation of Judah through the fire and the heat of His judgment, and He's going to purify them of a sin that threatened their very existence. So this lesson is going to be about judgment, but it's also about mercy and preservation. What we'll be discussing is the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., and the verse that sums up this whole lesson is from Psalms 137. Written in captivity from the depths of a broken heart, this is what it says. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. The important key to this lesson is that Judah would remember Zion, and she would remember how she lost it. Now, as we begin, we need to ask, why begin a study of church history in 586 B.C.? What is the connection between intertestamental Judaism and apostolic Christianity? Now, if you remember from last week, we said that one of the characteristics of the church is that it's unified across all ages and that there is just one people of God. So how does that fit with the idea of the so-called birth of the church at the day of Pentecost? Well, the use of the word birth makes a distinction, but it's not a separation. It marks the passage of the cross in history. Israel and the church are separated in time by the cross, but they're not separated in identity. The elect of the Old Testament Israel, and the elect of the New Testament church are equally God's called out people. Ecclesia means the called out ones, and it's almost uniformly translated the church. The term is peppered throughout the New Testament, especially in the book of Acts. And in the seventh chapter of that book, Stephen recounts the rejection of the law by Israel. And he speaks of Moses as being in the midst of the congregation in the wilderness. Now, the translators use the word congregation here, but the original word is ecclesia. Moses was in the midst of the church, and I believe that's the way the King James actually translates it. He's in the midst of the church in the wilderness. Now, the translators can rightly make a distinction, showing the difference that the cross has made in time, but we are amiss if we attempt to separate them. So when we speak of the birth of the church, what we're doing is we're using the language of Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2. Long ago, God spoke to the fathers, but in these last days, He has spoken to us in His Son. The text here makes a distinction between the fathers and us in time and in fullness of revelation, but the unity still remains. The life of the church began at its conception in Genesis, not at its birth at Pentecost. Okay? So now let's return to our question. What is the captivity in the years between the Testaments have to do with the birth of the church? Well, if the birth of the church is the day of Pentecost, then the intertestamental period, along with this captivity, is God's nesting period. I'm sure you're familiar with a woman's nesting period as she's about to give birth. It's a time in which God prepares the environment the church is going to be birthed into. Not only does He prepare for its birth, but He prepares for the church's infancy, for its protection, in order to preserve it as it grows. He even prepares for its growth among the heathens. And what that meant was He prepared for persecution, because the seed of the church is the blood of the martyrs. That's what made it grow. So the theme of the intertestamental years is that God prepares both the Jews and the Gentiles for the coming of the church. And that is what the intertestamental period is about, and that's why we're going to study it. Now, the very first step in that preparation was to rescue the Hebrew people from their own idolatry. And that's going to be our study today. When we look at history, history is mostly a series of cataclysmic or defining moments that begin this process of change in a people. They are course-altering events, leaving behind who they had been and changing them into something they will become. In our own brief history in this country, events like the war between the states, the Depression, World War II, have changed who we are as a people. Well, in the history of Israel, God interjected several of these defining moments. The Exodus, the giving of the law at Sinai, the building of the temple, King David's reign. All of these were defining moments that changed the course of Israel. But prior to the captivity, one thing remained constant in Israel. Generally speaking, the Hebrews were idolaters. They were not united by the Mosaic covenant. They were judged by it because they kept failing it. Baal and Molech and the various gods of Canaan were given what rightfully belonged to the God of Abraham. The Hebrews kept giving these idols their worship. Throughout the record of the Old Testament, Israel remained a fickle people who vacillated between the God of their fathers and the gods of the nations around them. The book of Judges reveals this pattern. You have Israel repeatedly turning to idolatry. God sends a nation to oppress them, until they finally return to God and cry out for deliverance. But after each deliverance, they fell right back into their idolatry. Here is where history seems to repeat. But it's because their idolatrous hearts never changed. It was always constant. And although God always had His remnant, Israel itself was losing its distinction as a special nation, as a special people. The greatest threat to the Hebrews was not their enemies, nor their armies. It was their obsession with marrying foreign women. It is probable that without God's intervention, the Hebrews would have intermarried themselves completely out of existence as a special people. They would have been assimilated into the cultures around them. How can we be sure of that? Because that's exactly what happened to the Israelites of the Northern Kingdom. When Israel and Judah divided, the northern kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians. And then in the first social engineering experiment in history, the Assyrians took all the northern tribes and deported them out of that kingdom and into the Assyrian Empire. Peoples from other lands then were relocated into North Palestine, and the 10 tribes of Israel simply disappeared from history. Now, for a time, they must have maintained some sense of identity. For the Assyrians, we have records of this, that they actually allow some priests to return to Palestine and teach the Samaritans about the lost worship of Yahweh. But that's the last we hear of them. They simply vanish. Not because of any great mystery. They simply melded into the culture around them through intermarriage. And they stopped being Israelites. Now, because of her idolatry, Judah would have followed the same path. But God sent an event so traumatic and so horrific that it forever changed what it meant to be a Jew. And that was the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, Judah had been warned. God's long suffering with her is a testament to His mercy. Perhaps no warning is so tragic than the one God Himself gave to Solomon. Here, as the temple was nearing completion, God gave his warning to Solomon. He said there would be a judgment against Israel and Judah should the nation turn to other gods. And we have that in 1 Kings 9, verses 8 and 9. For this house, which is exalted, speaking of the temple, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? Then they will answer, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods, and worshiped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this calamity upon them. But despite this warning, it was even Solomon who allowed the high places of his foreign wives to worship, and the people embraced other gods. And again, God was long-suffering. But when the evil king Manasseh revived the child sacrifices to the pagan god Moloch, the judgment was sealed. Even in the reign of good kings that followed, the Lord declares that the sins of Manasseh have not been cleansed. His judgment is still out there. So out of the east, out of Babylon, God raised up the instrument of his judgment in the form of Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldeans. Now the Chaldeans had conquered the Assyrians, who had conquered Israel. God had used the Assyrians' wicked intentions to judge Israel, and then he turned around and judged the Assyrians for their wicked intentions. Now initially, Judah was made a vassal state and allowed their own succession of vassal kings. But the Judeans rebelled, and Nebuchadnezzar put down the rebellion and gave the throne to Zedekiah. And he and Zedekiah entered into a covenant. Zedekiah would rule in Nebuchadnezzar's name and keep Judea in peace. But Zedekiah broke his covenant, despite the warnings of God's prophets. Jeremiah himself warned him with many tears. But Zedekiah and the Pharaoh of Egypt conspired together against Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar, remember, was Judah's sovereign, suzerain king. And so in 588 BC, the Chaldean army swept into Judea to put down this rebellion. Within weeks, only three Judean cities remained: Jerusalem and the walled cities of Lachish and Azekah. Now, I really want to get into a little bit of detail here because I want to get across how the horrors of these events changed the Judean people. Azekah fell first, and we know this from several sources, but archaeologists have recently uncovered messages between Joash, who was the commander of Lachish, and Jerusalem. They were scratched on little pieces of pottery shards and then carried by messenger. That's what they had to write on. One of the last dispatches that were discovered was this ominous message that Jerusalem was no longer receiving signals from Azekah. It was quiet. The city had fallen. So Joash would have known that Nebuchadnezzar was on his way. Now when he got there, the Chaldean king was in no mood for another long siege. So he put his engineers in charge of finding a way to quickly subdue the city. And what his engineers did was to deforest the land for miles around the city. Every bit of brush, every tree, every olive grove was cut down and brought to the city walls. The wood was piled as high as a house around the entire circumference of the walls, and they set it on fire. And for days, Lachish was an inferno. Day and night, the Chaldeans kept stoking this fire, until finally the white-hot stones burst and the walls caved in and everyone was put to the sword. Today, the most common artifact unearthed from Lachish are burnt olive pits from all the olive groves that were used in that fire. Now, that left only Jerusalem. Now, she was protected by valleys on three sides. Her walls were strong, and there weren't enough trees around the area to do what they had done at Lachish. So the city lay under siege for 18 months. And I don't think we can conceive of the horrors of a siege, because a siege is a slow, agonizing death of starvation and disease. Its victims are not only armies, they are families, they are children, they're the young, they're the old. And as the months passed by, the situation inside the city degenerated to the point that people were nothing more than the walking dead. Driven by hunger, mothers consumed their own children. And yet in the midst of this hopelessness, Zedekiah continued to look for help from Egypt instead of God. So Judah continued to play the harlot, even at this most troubling hour. But Egypt never came, and in the summer of 586 BC, the Chaldeans finally breached the walls and the city fell. And Zedekiah, who had escaped during the night, was captured near Jericho, and he was brought before Nebuchadnezzar and rebuked for being a covenant breaker. He was forced to watch his sons being put to death before he had his own eyes put out, which was the typical Babylonian punishment for treason. And there the 400-year-old reign of the family of David came to an end. And I want you to get the impact of this event. And Scripture itself doesn't hold anything back from the depiction of these horrors. I want to read a few portions of what is really the eulogy of the city, which we know as the Book of Lamentations. Listen to the way Jeremiah describes these events. And remember, when God warned Solomon, he had said, "Remember, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, 'Why has the Lord done this to this land and to this people?'" And God, through Jeremiah, reminds Judah of his warning to Solomon, because in the beginning, very similar words. Listen to Jeremiah. "All those who pass by clap their hands at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. 'Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, 'We have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we have waited for. We have found it. We have seen it.'" And so here is an event that no Jew is ever going to forget. And nor would God allow them to forget it, because he inspires Jeremiah to capture these images of a people who are ravaged by their own sins. And he continues. He says, "My eyes fill with tears. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. Because the children and the infants faint in the street. They say to their mothers, 'Where is grain and wine?' as they swoon like the wounded in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. See, O Lord, and consider to whom you have done this. Should the women eat their offspring, the children they have cuddled? Should the priest and the prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered and not pitied. The tongue of the infant clings to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The young children ask for bread, but no one breaks it for them. Now their appearance is blacker than soot. They go unrecognized in the streets. Their skin clings to their bones. It has become as dry as wood. Those slain by the sword are better off than those who die of hunger. For these pine away, stricken by lack of the fruits of the field. The hands of the compassionate women have cooked their own children. They became food for them in the destruction of the daughter of my people." So God will not be mocked. He will have his judgment. And yet, even in the midst of this judgment, Jeremiah recalls the mercy of the Lord. "For though Judah had been severely chastened and punished, the Lord has preserved her and was not consumed." He says, "My soul still remembers and sinks within me, but this I recall to my mind. Therefore I have hope. Through the Lord's mercies we are not consumed, because his compassion fails not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul, for I hope in him." He probably recognize some of that. We might view our choruses a little differently when we realize the context here. But most importantly, the message that God was sending to Judah was not lost on Jeremiah. And this is it. Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that woe and well-being proceed? Why should a man complain for the punishment of his sins? Now, a month later, in August of 586 BC, the captain of Nebuchadnezzar's guard put the temple to the flames. The walls were torn down. The city was left desolate. Thousands of Hebrews began an 800-mile forced march into Babylon, into captivity. Most of these were craftsmen. They were the aristocracy. They were the well-to-do or the upper class. The poorest of the people were given land and vineyards in Palestine and left to meek out whatever existence they could find. And just like the 10 tribes of Israel, those that were left behind soon melded into the people around them. And it is this mixture of races who meld together to become what were known as the Samaritans. Others ended up in Egypt, like Jeremiah. Jeremiah ended up in Egypt. Many of these refugees ended up along the Upper Nile in a colony called Elephantine. And there they actually built a new temple. They continued their sacrifices. Of course, the rest of Judaism considered that to be blasphemous. The only temple should be at Jerusalem. Okay, that's why they viewed it with horror. That temple was eventually destroyed in an anti-Jewish riot in 410 BC. But the reason why I mention them is because these refugees start a critical feature of the next few lessons. And it's a critical feature that God uses to prepare the world for the birth of the church. And it leads us to an important word, and that is the diaspora. It means dispersion. And it speaks of the Jews being dispersed out of Palestine and into the rest of the Mediterranean basin. And so in 586 BC, you have the start of the eastern diaspora, which is to go to Babylon. Then you also have the beginnings of the western diaspora that goes to Egypt. And these two dispersions are going to have very different futures and play very different roles in the intertestamental period. But both of them are going to be major features in God's preparation for the birth of the church. We're going to look at that a little closer in the next few weeks. So for the eastern diaspora, those in Babylon, the majority of the Hebrew captives were taken there and settled along the royal canals of the Euphrates River in and around the city. And just like Egypt in the days of Moses, it wasn't long before they were so numerous that the Chaldeans referred to that part of the city simply as the land of Israel. They had so many Hebrews there, they started calling the district the land of Israel. Now, ironically, it's during this time that the last of the Israelites became known as Jews. It's a corruption of the word Judah. Remember, the northern tribes, which were called Israel, had already vanished. And really all you had was Judah and Benjamin. And so now they simply became known as Judah, or corrupted into Jews. Now, in a sense, this transformation also represents this distinct change that happens in the very fabric of these people. Even though the Jews would develop into some factions, of course we know we had Sadducees and Pharisees, all of these factions, there is this religious unification that takes place in the Babylonian captivity that finally gives us that picture of the Jews that we're familiar with. That is, a people united under this one faith. And so the judgment that God placed upon them worked out a transformation in these people and finally unites them. It drove out the overt idolatry that had always plagued them. It was a reaction to both the destruction of Jerusalem and also to the conditions in which they found themselves. Sometimes God will allow that sin you've been chasing to begin to chase you. And that's exactly what happened to Judah when they were brought into Babylon. Because, as we said, for centuries they had flirted with idolatry and paganism, heathenism. And so God brought them right into the heart of paganism when He brought them to Babylon. He gave them a real close look at the depravity of human religion. because Babylon was a city built around religion. The life of the capital city there revolved around all of those rituals that were devoted to the dozens of deities that the Babylonians worshipped. In Babylon itself, there were 53 major temples and several hundred minor chapels scattered throughout the city in the surrounding suburbs. It had broad, straight avenues named after these Babylonian gods. There was a Marduk street. There was a Zababah street. There were streets named after the moon god. There were streets named after the sun god, Shamash. So everywhere the Jews turned, they were confronted with the guilt that they had been no different than their heathen captors in their idolatrous ways. Down the center of the city, down the center of Babylon, they had what was called the processional way, and it passed through this famous Ishtar gate. And at the end of that street stood an edifice that the Jews knew, one that represented man's rebellion against the God of the Bible. That was the Temple of Marduk, which we know as the Tower of Babel. Here was this huge terrace pyramid that towered over the waters of the Euphrates, and that was a constant reminder of God's judgment on Judah. Because they had lost the temple, the true temple of God, and now they were living in the shadow of the temple of man's rebellion. And something I thought that was very interesting is that the Bible helped identify this building for archaeologists, because if you look in Genesis 11, chapter 11, it talks about the construction of the Tower of Babel, and it says this. It says, "Let us make brick, burn them thoroughly," and they had brick for stone, and this translation says, "and slime for mortar." And it was this reference to slime that helped identify this building for archaeologists. The archaeologists had to remove millions of tons of rubble to get to Babylon because the Euphrates River itself had abandoned the city and changed its course. And today Babylon is surrounded by desert and it's desolate, just as God said it would be, by the way. But this slime was petroleum. And this is the middle of Iraq. Okay. They had covered the lower parts of this tower with a crude form of asphalt to protect it from the rising of the Euphrates. It was right on its banks. So the Bible helped identify what this building was. Now, the reaction of the Jews to Babylon then was one of horror. They recoiled as a people. Many of the Babylonian laws and religious rituals turned biblical morals on their head. One in particular, which we have a record of, is given to us by the Greek historian Herodotus. And he found this Babylonian practice particularly vicious. And this is what he has to say when he describes it. He said, "Every woman in the country is required by law to take her seat in the temple and once in her life consort with a stranger. And only when she had been with him was she allowed to go home. All the women who were tall and beautiful were quickly released, but the unattractive ones have to wait a long time before they can fulfill the law. Some of them have to wait 3 or 4 years." Now, imagine the reaction of the Jews to this. It had to be one of horror. And that's why the name Babylon became synonymous with immorality. It becomes the scriptural type of all depravity. Just one example from Revelation 17. Babylon, the great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. These people remembered what they saw and were exposed to in the heart of Babylon. So here the Jews were placed in this crucible. And it was under this pressure that the Jews finally turned to the God of their fathers. And they came to grips with their own idolatry. Here along the rivers of Babylon, God purified his people of this particular sin, and never again would the worship of false gods plague them as a nation. As strangers in a strange land, the Jews sought to protect themselves from their surroundings, from the culture around them. They began to use tradition as a hedge against the influence of the Babylonian culture. They returned to the faith of their forefathers, the faith in the one who had delivered them out of Egypt. And they also began to practice what God had demanded from them for centuries, racial purity. They didn't intermingle with the Babylonian culture. Okay? They did, however, adopt some of the practices of the Babylonians as far as skills. The Babylonians were consummate bureaucrats, so the Jews were quickly immersed and used in these capacities. And they learned to develop abilities in commerce and trade, which prior to this time, the Jews were not really a commercial people. But they are after this, after the captivity. In fact, it sounds somewhat stereotypical, but archaeologists have discovered that one of the first trades the Jews engaged in was banking there in Babylon. More importantly, they were able to use these skills to document family lineage. And that required the establishment and the bringing up of an entirely new religious leader. And that was the scribe. Without the temple sacrifice, the role of the priest declined, while the role of the scribe grew. There were no sacrifices in Babylon. Within a generation, these people were in danger of losing their cultural identity, so it became a race to preserve it or to lose it. A good example of this was that the language of the common man was becoming Aramaic, not Hebrew, something that they were picking up in Babylon. And so it became imperative that these people receive training in the faith of their forefathers, and to do that, they needed the office of the scribe. He became the person that would transmit the teaching, the instruction to the people. Judaism and Christianity both owe a great debt to the scribe. Of course, our view of the scribe is colored by Christ's rebuke of them. But that was centuries later when the scribes had added all these man-made traditions to God's law. What the scribe meant to the exiles was the preservation of their culture and their genealogy. They also represent the beginning of the systematic instruction of the people in the law of Moses. It's not simply the recitation of the law anymore. It's the discussion, the interpretation, and the application of the law. It became ingrained into the people. And that's what's going to be their hedge, their wall of protection, as they are in this hostile culture around them. And somewhere in the evolution of the scribe, you have also the beginnings of a new religious institution, which will eventually become the synagogue. We don't have all the details about how the synagogue was formed, but it happened, its early beginnings were here in Babylon. Now, to anticipate next week, I want to quickly mention the Persians. In 539 BC, from the mountains of modern-day Iran, the Persians swept into the Chaldean Empire, and through treachery, they took Babylon without a fight. And at the head of this army was Cyrus the Great, whom Scripture calls God's anointed. He was God's anointed means of judgment on the Babylonians. Even though he wasn't a believer, Cyrus the Great still remains one of the most attractive rulers in all of antiquity. And the reason is that he embraced a policy of religious and cultural toleration that was unknown in the world at that time. His basic policy was that whatever your religion is, you practice it. Whatever your culture is, you preserve it. He didn't force his subjects to adopt the Persian religions. And so within a year of taking possession of the empire, he issued a decree for the return of the Jews to Judea. And I have that here. It's in 2 Chronicles 36. It said, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom, and also put it into writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, the king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who among you, of all his people, may the Lord his God be with them and let him go up? He's giving them a return to their homeland. Okay. And this deliverance by the Persians makes a lasting impression upon the Jews. As Cyrus grew larger in legend over the centuries, this Jewish vision of their Messiah began to look more like a conquering Persian king, more like Cyrus. And so, if we fast forward to the war with the Romans in AD 70, the Jews kept looking to the east for deliverance. In fact, one rabbi said this: if you see a Persian horse tied to the gates of Jerusalem, look for the footsteps of the Messiah. So you can see how the deliverance of Cyrus had burnt itself into the national conscience. So much so that in the secret council of God, this vision of this warrior Messiah helped blind the Jews to the coming of Christ. Any questions out of all that material? No? Yes?
Mention about not knowing how the synagogue got started. Does it have anything to do with Solomon building the temple? The temple has nothing to do with the synagogue, right?
No. In fact, the synagogue is developed because there is no temple.
Okay.
And what the synagogue, we don't have all the details on how it first was formed. We just know the general time frame when these small areas of teaching began to develop. And we realize that it comes from Babylon and then spreads. But the important thing about the synagogue is that it's the model for the church. It becomes the model. Most of the things that the church does have their roots in the synagogue. Okay. Some of the other things that are important that I hope you picked up during this lesson about this time is that God here preserves the uniqueness of this people. Without that, the Messiah doesn't come to His people, right? Because there would be no people to come to. So He preserves them, their uniqueness. And He did that by sending them through the captivity, through the terrible things that Jeremiah is describing in Lamentations. He puts them through that to purge that, to bring that up like in a crucible, bring that dross up to the surface so it can be wiped away. Okay, He does that to preserve them. Another thing that's important about the scribe is that he preserves these genealogies. Probably the genealogies that we have in the New Testament owe a debt to the scribe. He's the one that would write out all of these family trees. And so we know that Christ comes from the house of David, probably because at some point some scribe was writing down who begot who, right? Okay? Very important. Since those genealogies are important for the coming of the Messiah, to validate Him. Okay? So that's another important aspect of the development of the scribe. Cliff?
This is just something I just contemplate listening to you. You know, in the days that you talked about God's fingerprint on man and in history, as He preserves the people and the sieges of the cities and all that took place, allowed all of that mapping, I guess you would say, to occur. From a spiritual perspective, all those folks that suffered and went through all the horrors that we talked about, though they were, you know, elected as a people or as a nation by God, it appears from a spiritual perspective that they were eternally lost even still. Is that true?
Well, I mean, there's no way to determine who is actually lost from a spiritual standpoint and who isn't. Just because there is a remnant that God has, there is a true elect of God, doesn't mean that He will automatically preserve them from having to go through these types of things.
Correct.
Okay? So He elects them as a people, just as you said. And within that, then, is this remnant, just like you have the visible church and the invisible church. But when God's judgment passes through here, it doesn't mean that He took away the remnant and preserved them and kept them from having to go through this. What it means is that those people that went through the siege there at Jerusalem, all of those horrors, some of them, once that was over, once they died, they went to bliss. But for others, the horrors were just beginning. Okay, and we don't know who is who, obviously. Any other questions?
I just have one more.
Sure.
About Babylon, when you said that what the women were expected to do and the immorality and everything, did that last for a long time? Or I mean, do you know how long that lasted?
I don't know exactly how long, but it was something that was common in their culture. It was ingrained in their culture. How it developed and how long it lasted, I don't know. But that was a part of their worship. And, of course, we see this same type of thing with a little different twist, like in the New Testament at Corinth, where you had these temple prostitutes. Well, in this case, every woman was expected by law to have to go to this temple and consort with a stranger before they could leave the temple. And as Herodotus points out, if you were attractive, well, I mean, you're there for a day and you're gone. But if you're not so attractive, you may be there for years. It's just horrible, terrible.
Our depravity goes back a long way.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that system, I mean, it's built upon that depravity. I mean, it just brings it to the forefront, you know. Anything else? Okay, when we start looking next week, we'll start seeing how some of these little things that I've brought up today affect more and more the bigger picture as God really does prepare the Mediterranean world for the coming of the Messiah. Okay, the synagogue is going to be very, very important. The diaspora is very critical because, as we're going to see, the diaspora starts taking these Jews around the Mediterranean basin, which means when the gospel comes, there are places for them to go. For these evangelists to go. When they go to a city anywhere in the Mediterranean world, they first go to the synagogue and say, You fellow Jews here have been expecting the Messiah. Well, he has come. And so God places these all around that area, ready places of evangelism. Anything else?
And even with that, they still reject it.
Some of them. God's elect, you know. Okay. Cliff, would you close, please?
Yes. Let's bow our heads. Well, gracious Heavenly Father, we just come before you, Lord, just grateful, Lord, for the opportunity to learn and to engage in some deeper understanding, Father, and the wisdom and the architecture of that which you've done.